You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
Sometimes I am a conspiracy theorist, but I only believe in the conspiracy theories that are true.
We're formally classifying fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction.
No blood for oil.
Early indications point to a terrorist attack inspired by Islamic State.
Antisemitism, religious hatred, violent extremism and terror have no place in our society.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Katrina Stewart in our Sydney newsroom, back this week with international correspondent Claudia Farhat in Jakarta. Hello, Claudia.
Hello, Kat. Very lovely to be back with you for episode 41 of the podcast, which sadly will also be our very last one for the year before we go on a little break.
It will. And we don't usually talk about domestic news on the pod, but this week, naturally, the world's attention turned closer to home as terrorism came to the iconic sands of Bondi Beach, two alleged gunmen targeting a Jewish celebration, taking the lives of 15 innocent people, including a 10-year-old girl.
Yeah, we'll be taking you through how this really horrific event has rippled across the globe this week. Our chief political correspondent, Anna Henderson, is going to be joining us from Canberra, talking us through what's known about these alleged attackers' extremist links.
We're also going to be chatting with our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis, about the latest round of negotiations to end the war in Ukraine.
Plus, Donald Trump declares another ceasefire in Thailand and Cambodia, but the fighting is only getting worse.
First off, a warning: some listeners may find the following audio distressing.
It's a lot of gunshots.
People just started screaming and running like I've never seen before, you know what I mean?
A tragic event that will forever go down in history as one of Australia's darkest days. 15 people killed after two alleged gunmen opened fire on crowds attending a Hanukkah celebration at Bondi Beach early Sunday evening. It's the worst mass shooting Australia has seen since the Port Arthur massacre in 1996 and the worst single terror event in the nation's history. The two alleged gunmen have since been identified as father and son, 50-year-old Sajid Akram, who was shot and killed in an exchange of gunfire with police, and 24-year-old Navid Akram, who has now been charged with 59 offences, including murder and terrorism.
So far, investigators are alleging that the shooting was ideologically motivated by IS. A car at Bondi Beach, which was registered to Navid, contained two homemade IS flags, along with improvised explosive devices. Police say the father and son had travelled to the Philippines last month, and it's being reported they underwent military-style training there, although there are now conflicting reports as well from the Philippines that they hardly left their hotel during their time there. This was all on the island of Mindanao, which has been a hotspot really for militant activity since the 1990s. It's also where IS fighters held siege to the city of Marawi back in 2017. Filipino forces declared all-out war on them, and the government later said the group was defeated. But militants with links to the group have remained active in the region ever since. And even though IS more broadly was also declared defeated, we have continued to see attacks across Africa, Asia, Europe and North America, inspired by the group's ideology ever since. After the October 7 attacks, security experts told us that they had evidence the subsequent war on Gaza was being used as a propaganda tool by remnants of the group, and we saw more and more reports of isolated attacks and incidents motivated by IS after that. Thinking back to the beginning of this year, Kat, there was the lone attacker in New Orleans who killed 15 people by driving his truck into a crowd. He was also brandishing an IS flag.
That's right. And security experts are now worried about the potential for copycat attacks in other parts of the world. Let's get more with Anna Henderson, SBS World News Chief Political Correspondent, who's joining us now. Hello, Anna. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys. It's been such a horrific week. It's good to be, I guess, at a point where maybe there are some answers coming to the surface.
So speaking of those answers, this has obviously raised a host of questions about the strength of Australia's intelligence and security to combat extremism and terror. What's the latest response from the PM, Anna?
Well, we've had a couple of days now where everyone, I think, politically has been kind of reeling from the news and trying to work out how to chart some kind of national course forward. The Prime Minister has been under increasing pressure from the Jewish community across the country, but particularly I think people have been magnetised to that tribute site in Bondi, and it's there that we've seen some of the most kind of passionate pleas for more action to be taken to deal with anti-Semitism kind of coming to an apex yesterday when former Liberal Treasurer Josh Frydenberg gave a speech. He has been raising concerns about anti-Semitism in the community for the last 2 years, and it's been an increasing level of worry. He's even interviewed the Prime Minister previously about the concerns of the community. So this hasn't come out of nowhere, but he was saying that the Prime Minister hadn't done enough, that the Prime Minister had questions to answer, and the Prime Minister needed to take responsibility for what had happened on the weekend. We then saw Anthony Albanese today call a press conference here in Canberra, where he's unfolded essentially what you'd see is a 5-point kind of plan to try and address the criticism and try and address the feeling of public hurt and fear that's now really seeping into that community. He also, it must be said, responded to that question about his own part and his own role as Prime Minister, and he said governments are not perfect, I am not perfect, and we've engaged in a constructive way. So he has been trying to, I guess, address some of that criticism, though it did take a significant amount of questions in the press conference to get to the point where he was willing to make that comment. And over the last couple of days he has been previously asked why more wasn't done to try and deal with these things previously. So in relation to those points that the government is now taking up to try and address the issues, one of the critical ones is there's going to be new legislation to crack down more on hate speech, on anyone practicing hate in Australia, the idea of this hate preacher culture of people who are able to operate in Australia, potentially radicalise, gather people together and are not being prosecuted, and if they are not actually Australian citizens, are not being potentially deported from Australia. That's all going to change under this legislation if it comes through Parliament as planned, and there'll be a much more direct way for the government to cancel visas, to apprehend people, to prosecute people if they are saying and doing things which are now considered to be taken up in the remit of anti-Semitism and racism. Another part of what the government is promising to do here is to launch an anti-Semitism education task force, which will be headed by an eminent education expert, David Gonski, and would be really looking closely at whether or not there's enough education about the history of anti-Semitism across the world, as well as what's been happening on university campuses, which has been raised on a regular basis as an area where anti-Semitism has been allegedly allowed to flourish. So the government is certainly trying to now give a bit of a blueprint for how it can respond. It's also announced measures around dealing with online anti-Semitism and the spread of hatred. It's all folding into a bigger conversation, though, about migration into Australia, which is an international conversation, really. But there's pressure from the opposition for there to be some kind of Australian values test. The opposition suggesting it should be an anti-Semitism test, but something which anyone who wants to become an Australian citizen has to confront and be able to show that they don't, to use the words of the Prime Minister, have hate for Australia. So this is a really challenging conversation for the country to have. Australia is such a multicultural country, about, you know, how the government might respond to this, and there will be a lot of concern about any unintended consequences on the fringes. But it was quite clear that the Prime Minister needed to confront the criticism of him personally and the criticism of his government.
The other big conversation all of this has unleashed, Anna, is around our gun laws as well. If we think back to ASIO's annual threat assessment this year, the Director General, Mike Burgess, pointed out that the greatest risk in Australia remains lone actors who can use easily obtainable weapons. There was the big push after the Port Arthur massacre to tighten gun laws, but the enforcement seems to have relaxed in recent years. How's the government handling that side of things?
Yeah, it's a complex area in terms of different laws that are in place in different parts of the country. But I think what it all distills down to is, how is it possible that someone who lived in the sort of suburbs of one of our major capital cities had ownership legally of 6 long arm weapons? Why is that something that is acceptable in Australia, even after the Port Arthur massacre and the gun laws that came into force, and an international perception that Australia is very tough on gun laws? So this is an area where the government is now looking nationally to coordinate a tightening up of gun ownership. But it's also spoken to a conversation around how our intelligence agencies, which often operate in the shadows as they try to work out, you know, and apprehend terrorist networks before they operate, how they communicate with law enforcement. Because the other element of this that's come to light is that the gun license that the father, Sajid Akram, had was issued to him in 2023, and that was a couple of years after his son had come to the attention of ASIO on the periphery of an alleged sort of terrorist cell in Sydney. And interviews had been conducted with both father and son. But in the end, the decision had been made by the intelligence agencies at that point that they didn't pose any clear current threat. But none of that information appears to have made its way in a really clear sense to New South Wales Police. Or if it has, it wasn't taken into account as a factor that should stop that gun license from being approved a couple of years later. So there are just moments in this case which have really brought to light holes in the system that it appears have been failures in the lead up to what's occurred.
The repercussions of this attack are now being felt right around the world, particularly among Jewish communities. We saw increased security in New York, where thousands turned out for Hanukkah celebrations. Rabbi Velvel Butman shared this message of peace.
They want to be here to show their identity. They want to make sure that the flame of the Jewish people continues to shine brightly, and indeed the flame of democracy and freedom.
We also heard Palestinians in Gaza reacting in horror to what happened as well. This is a bit of what Ibrahim Rajab had to say.
We received this news with great shock. This is something neither we nor our people condone, and we utterly reject this act. We do not desire these attacks at all, as they offend every Arab, every Palestinian, and every Muslim in the entire world.
World leaders reached out to the PM following the incident to pay their respects, including US President Donald Trump, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer, and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, just to name a few. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has blamed Anthony Albanese directly, saying the incident was a result of Australia's support for Palestinian statehood.
On August 17th, about 4 months ago, I sent Prime Minister Albanese of Australia a letter in which I gave him warning that the Australian government's policy was promoting and encouraging anti-Semitism. Instead, Prime Minister, you replaced weakness with weakness and appeasement with more appeasement. Your government did nothing to stop the spread of anti-Semitism in Australia.
The Israeli diaspora minister going so far as to say Albanese had blood on his hands. The PM has declined to respond directly to those comments, calling for national unity, but has since rejected the Israeli Prime Minister's link between Australia's recognition of Palestinian statehood and Sunday's anti-Semitic terror attack in Bondi. Anna, has this reignited the debate on Palestinian recognition in Australia?
Well, I think in the early stages there was more discussion about the potential claim that there was some link. in the wake of the Israeli Prime Minister's comment. But the reality is that when I put that comment to the anti-Semitism envoy, Julian Siegel, in Australia, and said, do you think Palestinian statehood played a role here? She was entirely unwilling to put herself in a position where she was charting that on some kind of course to this. What she was wanting to highlight, though, was the protest movement, the pro-Palestinian protest movement in particular, and also the protests on the steps of the Opera House after October 7, and in particular moments that she alleges and she claims where anti-Semitic hate was able to rise to the surface during the course of those events. Now, we know there were many people at those events who were in no way raising those issues or doing anything which she could claim to be anti-Semitic. But at the same time, and there were Jewish people amongst those protesters as well, but at the same time, there were slogans and flags and other paraphernalia and comments made that she says were anti-Semitic and that shouldn't have been allowed. And that the idea that hate speech has been allowed to operate in Australia in that way, in a visible way, has helped to sort of lay a path towards emboldening more dangerous action. So that's her contention. But it certainly doesn't appear to back in those original comments from Benjamin Netanyahu. And there have been a lot of international comments on this that have sheeted blame in different areas, because I also note that the Director of National Intelligence in the US, Tulsi Gabbard, has put out her own statement over the past couple of days and given a view that she thinks this was an Islamist issue in Australia, something which she says is an international problem. And we have seen in Australia some Liberal backbenchers like Andrew Hastie really leaning into this idea that this is extremist Islamist ideology, which is behind this, going so far as to say in his contention that Australia should be prioritising Judeo-Christian or Anglo-Celtic immigration to Australia. So you can see the kind of conversation, the very vexed conversation that this is opening up around immigration to Australia. And also I think that there has been, even amongst many in the Jewish community that I've spoken to, leaders who've been very upset by the Australian government's response and acknowledgement that some of the things that were said early on directly from Israel were not comments that they were willing to back up. And even the Israeli ambassador, when he went to Bondi for those tributes, didn't repeat some of the things that were said out of Israel.
Yeah, I mean, speaking about social cohesion after all of this, politicians all the way up to the Prime Minister have been quite keen to celebrate Ahmed al-Ahmed, the Syrian migrant who risked his life to disarm one of the gunmen during this attack. We've also heard comments, quite strong comments, from some sectors of the public and from some sectors of politics against that very kind of migration. I mean, what sort of impact is this going to have on social cohesion in our country?
I feel like Chris Minns, the New South Wales Premier, was pretty blunt in his assessment yesterday when he was talking about a plan that the New South Wales government is going to recall Parliament to put in place to prevent mass demonstrations over the next couple of weeks. And in giving a justification for that, he said one of the most concerning factors for him is that there's a combustible situation in New South Wales. And if a flame was ignited, these are his words, he's worried it wouldn't be able to be extinguished. So if you wanted a clear-eyed view of just how challenging the situation is, the police resources that are now being taken up in patrolling different parts of Sydney and keeping an eye on different religious venues, from synagogues to mosques, to try and turn down the temperature and try and prevent any kind of retribution. This is a live issue, particularly in New South Wales, and there's an awareness that as these funerals unfold and just the level of sadness and anguish continues to unfold, and you know, wall-to-wall media coverage of this, of course, continues, that there are really challenging roles for leaders to try and promote a sense of unity when there are such strong divisions and frustrations in the communities.
Clearly a very complex issue, both in terms of security but also politically and socially, for the Australian government as well, Anna. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Some things, in my opinion, are destructive and definitely will not help us. And it is important that I do not see them today in the new versions of our documents. This is important to me because dignity matters, and the issue of land concessions is definitely not relevant.
Volodymyr Zelensky there explaining there are some things he does like and some things he very much does not like in the latest draft of the US peace plan to end Russia's war in Ukraine. The Ukrainian president spent 2 days in Berlin meeting with White House Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and Donald Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner.
At the end of it all, the Americans sounded very positive, the Ukrainians less so. But agreeing progress has been made, Zelensky now saying a proposal could be finalised in a matter of days. Following events from London has been our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis, who joins us now. Ben, why are the Americans sounding so chipper about how things are going?
Hey guys, well, they genuinely think they're making Kyiv a good offer, and they have gone much further than they have in past rounds of negotiations. Washington now says it's willing to provide so-called NATO Article 5-style security guarantees. They would, in theory, mean that if Russia tried to invade again or resumed firing missiles into Ukraine, for example, then the US would come to the rescue, militarily speaking. It's the sort of thing Kyiv wants not just in writing, but also ratified by the US Congress, and that is apparently something the Americans are now happy to do. One US official in Berlin said they think the deal is 90% done, but remember that remaining 10% includes the most difficult issue of all, land concessions. President Zelensky has again made it clear he's not prepared to give up the parts of the Donbass region that Ukraine still holds. That's something Moscow has been demanding. And when the Ukrainian president suggested land swaps would have to be approved by a referendum, he did so knowing that there's little chance such a move would actually be backed by the Ukrainian public. That's if a referendum could be held in the first place, given the security situation.
And Ben, what's the response to all of this been from Moscow so far?
Well, for now, the Kremlin's chief spokesman has said they're waiting to receive a revised draft of the peace plan from the US, rather than reacting to the ideas being discussed in the press at the moment. But we have heard from Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. He was speaking with Iranian state media and claimed the US has promised Russia not to accept Ukraine into NATO and will facilitate the transfer of territories, referring, we presume, to the parts of Ukraine Russia claims as its own. Whether that's true or not, we don't know. One thing Moscow will reject completely is a proposal put forward by European leaders in Berlin for a Europe-led multinational force to preserve the post-war peace, with some of those troops operating inside Ukraine itself. So even if the US and Ukraine settle on a final plan with European input, it's almost certain Moscow will say, this doesn't work for us.
So with the year almost over, what is the likelihood of a deal being done by Christmas, as Donald Trump apparently wants?
It's very, very unlikely. The Kremlin is in no rush here. Vladimir Putin feels like his forces have the upper hand on the front line, although President Zelensky's recent visit to Pokrovsk, which Russia had claimed to have captured, shows that's perhaps not entirely accurate. Still, neither side wants to be the one that says a definitive no to Donald Trump. So both Zelensky and Putin are likely to continue this game of saying yes, but, where they don't outright reject the deal that's on the table, but don't agree to it entirely either. The question is, how long will it be before the US president throws his hands in the air and goes, look, I tried, you guys can fight it out? And then who will he blame? The Ukrainians fear they already know the answer. Ask the Europeans how things are going. Well, there are two very different answers. We heard from the German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, who said there's a small but real chance for a deal soon. Poland's Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, was asked how things are going. He said he didn't want to spoil the good mood and atmosphere after Berlin, but said he remains a cautious optimist, more cautious than optimist.
Thank you, Ben, for the update and for all the updates on the pod this year. We hope you get a good break over Christmas.
Thanks, guys. Have a great break. A happy new year. May it be a happier year than this one has been.
And I hate to say this, one named Cambodia, Thailand, that had started up today, tomorrow I'll have to make a phone call and I think they'll get it. Who else could say, I'm going to make a phone call and stop a war of two very powerful countries, Thailand and Cambodia? They're going at it again. But I'll do it.
Well, the US president did make those phone calls late on Friday evening. And on Saturday morning, after 6 days of intense cross-border clashes, the world woke to the news, delivered by Donald Trump himself, that he had successfully brokered another ceasefire between Thailand and Cambodia. But any actual hopes that the bloodshed might be over were quickly crushed. The fighting not only continued after the president's announcement, but it seemed to get even worse. Claudia, you've just returned from reporting on the Thai-Cambodian border. Talk us through how it happened on the ground. What went wrong? How did we go from Trump's declaration of peace to even more intense fighting?
Yeah, it was pretty obvious that something was off from the start, Kat, because we were getting all these different versions of events after these phone calls that happened late on Friday. So Donald Trump came out and, you know, declared another victory. They've agreed to stop the fighting immediately. But then the Thai Prime Minister, Nutan Charnvirakul, gave a statement. He said the phone call went well, but he didn't make any reference to a ceasefire. The Cambodian Prime Minister, Hun Manet, made a statement. He said he welcomed Donald Trump's help, but he didn't make any reference to a ceasefire either. And then the other person who was involved, the Malaysian Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim, also gave a statement, also didn't reference any kind of agreement, and said he was actually going to urgently try to gather the ASEAN foreign ministers to try to find a solution to this. Within hours, everyone's suspicions were confirmed because the Cambodian government started reporting Thai airstrikes with F-16 fighter jets deep into Cambodian territory that they were continuing. Then the Thai Prime Minister came out and gave another statement. He said, "Our actions this morning have already spoken and that we will continue our military action until we feel no more threat." Only the day earlier, Anutin Charnvirakul had dissolved the Thai parliament to trigger early elections. He has been all week since, I guess, close to 2 weeks now, since this fighting broke out once again, trying to project this image of strength, right, as opposed to his predecessor, Pei Tong Tan Shinawat, who was kind of seen as too soft on Cambodia. He's been talking tough, saying he's not going to negotiate with them. And nationalists inside Thailand love it. So now analysts are thinking, he's taking this path. He's not going to want to find an end, an off-ramp to this war anytime soon, because going into an election campaign, it really suits him to have all of that heightened rhetoric.
And since then, the fighting's only spread further. At least 40 people have been killed. That number is still rising every day. And now Cambodia is reporting Thai airstrikes far deeper into its territory than before, including around its biggest tourism hub. What's the feeling in the region, Claudia, about where this is going next?
Well, the feeling is that it's already in uncharted territory, Kat. I mean, Cambodia is now reporting airstrikes deep inside Siem Reap. This is about 70 kilometres across the border. We were looking at an evacuation area before that was more in the range of 30 to 40 kilometres. So it's far deeper into that territory. It's also, Cambodia says, where it has evacuated some of those civilians from border villages too. So they're now concerned about their safety further inside the territory. It's also far from the disputed lines along the border. So there are questions being asked about why Thailand is targeting this area in particular. And as you mentioned, it's Cambodia's number one tourism hub. We're talking about bombs falling. We've seen bridges destroyed within about 70 to 80 kilometres of Angkor Wat, right? The ancient temples, Cambodia's biggest tourism draw card. So there's really a risk of this spiralling out of control now. Anwar Ibrahim, the Malaysian Prime Minister, still the ASEAN chair for a few more weeks. He was going to convene the ASEAN foreign ministers this Monday. That was delayed at the very last minute at Bangkok's request, apparently. It's been rescheduled for next Monday, and hopes are now sort of firmly pinned on that for finding a solution to this. Because in the meantime, since he came out and declared that they'd agreed to a ceasefire, we haven't really seen Donald Trump weigh in on this at all. He hasn't acknowledged that the fighting's ongoing. We don't know if he's still trying to find a solution to it. It has been interesting watching China's part in all of this, though. Originally, it looked like they were completely staying out of it, which a lot of analysts sort of saw as a reflection of how difficult this one is to resolve. They didn't want to, you know, I guess unlike what we've, the tactic we've seen from Washington of speaking publicly and then hoping for a result, they didn't really want to take that path. But now in the days since Donald Trump declared this ceasefire, which obviously was never going to hold, was never real, we have had reports that Beijing's working very quietly behind the scenes, trying to mediate a solution between Thailand and Cambodia. If it's successful, I mean, we already know that this year has been all about the competition for influence between China and US in this part of the world. If it's successful, that would be a major win for Beijing to be able to say, we were able to deliver peace, we were able to return stability when Washington couldn't. So one for us to watch, I think.
And there have, of course, been plenty of other big stories around the world this week. Here are just a few. The latest move by the United States to pressure Venezuela's government has really upped the ante. US President Donald Trump has now ordered a full blockade of sanctioned Venezuelan oil tankers entering and leaving the country and has labelled Maduro and his government a foreign terrorist organisation. He had just signed an order designating fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction. The US has significantly ramped up their military presence in the region with more than 20 military strikes on vessels in the Pacific Ocean and Caribbean Sea near Venezuela, which have killed at least 90 people.
President Trump has also repeatedly threatened to launch a ground invasion in Venezuela, despite legal experts already suggesting his military's attacks on ships in international waters likely violates both US and international law. The UN has also rejected the US's labeling of drug trafficking groups as terrorist organizations as a means of justifying these attacks. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is accusing Donald Trump of creating a pretext for war.
We may well be devoting a lot more time to this story when we're back in the new year, but turning now to the trial of Hong Kong's most prominent pro-democracy voice, which has come to an end after 5 years. Founder of the now-defunct Apple Daily newspaper, Jimmy Lai, has been found guilty under the city's draconian new national security laws. He was convicted of colluding with foreign governments and of sedition in relation to dozens of op-eds he penned for the paper that were critical of China. Lai has always denied the charges against him. He'll return to court for sentencing next month and faces a maximum penalty of life in jail. He's now 78 years old and his children say his health is deteriorating rapidly.
Yeah, this is the highest profile case to come out of China's now 5-year-old national security laws. Lai's supporters and human rights advocates around the world say if there were any lingering doubts over Beijing's grip on Hong Kong or over the state of press freedom in the city, they've now been quelled with this verdict. Western governments have reacted with outrage, but it's had pretty much no effect. US President Donald Trump petitioned the Chinese President Xi Jinping for his release earlier this year with no success. His children are now asking the UK government to reevaluate its entire relationship with China, given Lai has been a British citizen since the 1990s.
And far-right candidate José Antonio Kast has won Chile's presidential runoff, part of a wider shift to far more conservative politics in the region. A staunch Catholic, Kast opposes abortion and same-sex marriage and has a hardline approach to migration and crime. He's another far-right leader claiming to take inspiration from US President Donald Trump and is the first president since the end of Chile's dictatorship in 1990 to support dictator Augusto Pinochet.
Kast has echoed President Trump's policy and rhetoric in other ways as well, pledging to build a wall at Chile's border with Peru and Bolivia, as well as maximum security prisons, and calling for the mass deportation of irregular migrants. Chile is considered one of the safest and more stable South American countries, but a rise in immigration and in organized crime has influenced voters, although critics have said that those problems have been exaggerated.
And lastly, to Africa, and a rebel leader in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo says his fighters will withdraw from the city of Uvira, which the M23 rebels captured just days ago. They say it was a gesture of goodwill. Corne Nanga's statement comes after US Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the capture of Uvira by rebel forces violated a peace deal and Washington will, quote, take action to ensure promises made to President Trump are kept.
This recent escalation in fighting has triggered even more large-scale displacement within the DRC and across the border. Around 64,000 refugees have already arrived in neighbouring Burundi, and the influx is expected to continue. A lot of the displaced are highly vulnerable people. Many have urgent medical needs and little access to shelter. There are unaccompanied minors who've been separated from their families as well, and a high portion of the displaced are women.
Claudia, I can't quite believe I'm saying this, but for the last time in 2025, that is The World This Week.
Aww.
The team will be taking a very short 2-week break, but we'll be back in January to bring you all the big global news stories as they unfold.
Yes, and a big thank you to our wonderful team of producers. They are Nick Ludlam, Ali Cheevers, and Billy Dallenberg for all of their hard work throughout the year and for, more often than not, providing us snacks as well. Mm. It's been greatly appreciated, guys. And most importantly, Kat, thanks to our listeners for tuning in to this brand new podcast we launched at the beginning of the year from the World News Weekly team. We hope you all have a really good end to the year, a good break, and we're looking forward to seeing you in the new year.
Absolutely. And as always, if you've been enjoying the show, be sure to like and subscribe. Our episodes are also available on YouTube. It's been a big year for the pod and an even bigger year for world news. I'm sure we can all agree. We'll leave you now with a look back at the highs and lows of 2025. See you in 2026, Claudia.
Catch you then, Kat.
This is the historic dawn of a new Middle East.
People want to see an end to the cycle of violence.
Putin wants legal recognition for what he has stolen.
It is Europe's destiny that is at stake.
You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III.
And Daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
I don't think people should be taking advice, medical advice, right, from me.
I will walk in that Capitol and I'll say every damn name that abused these women.
People are being deliberately deprived of the very basic means to survive.
These people are dead because their lives didn't matter enough to us. Us being the governments of the world.
Our country has been looted, pillaged, raped, and plundered by nations near and far.
Vulnerable countries will continue to pay the highest price for a crisis we did not create.
In America, we the people will rule.